now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Sergio Aguero's time at Manchester City is to come to an end. Where does he rank amongst the Premier League's greatest ever strikers? Scotland are unbeaten in their opening three World Cup qualifiers. We'll rate their chances of getting to another major tournament under boss Steve Clarke. We'll touch on the winners and losers of the international break when it comes to Gareth Southgate's England and ask what's next for England's under-21s after their awful Euro showing. Before we end the podcast with the greatest upsets in international football after North Macedonia shocked the Germans. That's all coming up on today's episode of the Game Podcast. To help me through it all, Tom Roddy, Gregor Robertson and Jonathan Northcroft. Hi guys, how you doing?
Good morning, Hugh.
Very well, Hugh.
How you doing?
Very good, Hugh.
Good to hear you're all ecstatic to be here. let's talk international football. We'll come to that in a moment. Of course, a busy, busy international break. But I guess the news of the week for many football fans was Manchester City's Sergio Aguero. After 10 years, 257 goals in 384 games. He's on the verge, by the way, of a fifth Premier League title. He's won an FA Cup, five League Cups. He'll desperately want to finish on a high at Manchester City with the Premier League, but he is leaving the club this summer. Jonathan, he leaves on a free transfer. Why do you think the club has parted ways with a 32-year-old?
Because they're a machine without him, quite frankly, because they've got to the point where they can do without him. It's probably the right time for Sergio Aguero too, because he's had a year out of football effectively because of his injuries and then being on the bench since he's come back, because Guardiola hasn't wanted to change a winning team. He's early 30s. He clearly needs to go somewhere and play. And there's a feeling that things have come to the sort of natural end there. Also, City are now got their eyes fixed on the next phase and the next level, shall we say, with Erling Haaland in their sights, maybe Jack Grealish, and building a new team. So it just feels like it's time. The odd thing about it for such a sensational player is it means that his exit is happening rather quietly, with not the sort of fanfare, let's say, of Thierry Henry's goodbye, or even when Van Persie was sort of leaving United. It seems like a great is kind of going to slip out of the Premier League quietly.
I think he's been absolutely remarkable. He's going to get a statue outside the stadium alongside former captains Vincent Kompany and David Silva. Maybe the trio epitomised this change to Manchester City under the new owners. But where does he rank amongst the Premier League's greatest ever goal scorers? He, of course, is the club's greatest. He's the record holder at Manchester City. He scored 181 Premier League goals, though. That's fourth of all time. Gregor, what do you think? Where does he rank?
Well, in terms of a pure goal scorer in the Premier League era, he's the best. I mean, you look at the minutes per goal ratio as well. I think it's 108. And Thierry Henry was next with 121 goals per minute. So, minute per goal. So, yeah, he's the best in terms of an out-and-out goal scorer. I mean, you know, when you broaden the debate into what a striker can be and what else they do for the team, you know, that's a bigger conversation. But for that cold, calculated kind of, I don't know, he always seems to have that bit of composure, the ability to take the extra touch when others would kind of panic, and always smash the ball into the net. It's like, you know, you get some players who, you know, Henri's kind of trademark goal is to open his body up and find a corner. Aguero's really is that drive, isn't it? It's that smashing it beyond the keeper before he can even, you know, blink. So, in terms of an out-and-out goal scorer, pure finisher for a striker in the Premier League era, he's the best.
Sad to see him go in some ways, Tom Roddy?
Yeah, absolutely. And as Johnny rightly said, I hadn't thought about that, but it's such a shame that he will go out so quietly. Because, of course, when we look back on Aguero in now and in years to come, you know, it'll always be that moment, winning the Premier League title, which he'll be remembered for. I mean, it's emblazoned. Martin Tyler's commentary from that day is emblazoned across the walls as you walk to the Etihad, and they have the 93-20 sweep, which marks the second that they won it that year. And of course, it was marking the moment that City won the trophy. But it's Aguero who's written into the history. But I think what may be forgotten when we do look back on Aguero from years to come is one of his biggest achievements, which was dealing with the challenge of Pep Guardiola arriving at the club. Because, you know, we hear about all the players who he's improved, and he has improved in pretty much each and every one of them. But Aguero was, 29 in 2018 when he was out of the squad, and a bit in and out of the squad, and you had Gabriel Jesus coming in, and we thought he might be the one to replace him. Aguero wasn't quite the right man for Guardiola, and he was being eased out. So his most challenging period of the season, by February that year, he'd scored 18 goals in 26 games. And so a guy who's 29 years old could probably think at that time that he's not doing a lot wrong here, but he didn't. He got on board with what Guardiola wanted and really kind of adapted his game. And I think that's what makes Aguero quite special, actually, in the conversation of strikers who have, you know, Premier League imports and strikers, is that he's not... We only really know him as the player rather than the personality.
There's a big decision to make over who replaces Sergio Aguero. Already people talking about Erling Braut Haaland, there's Kylian Mbappe, there's a possibility of Harry Kane as well. You know, it always surprises me that they would give out these statues so readily. Of course, they've won a lot, let's call it that, in the last 10 or so years. But, you know, one of these players could easily surpass Sergio Aguero. There's going to be statues everywhere around this Etihad Stadium in 30 years' time. Gregor, I'll start with you. Who can fill his boots?
I mean, it just sets up the conversation about Haaland, doesn't it? But it's going to be one long kind of courtship of Haaland, I think, between now and the summer. Lots of clubs will be desperate to get a hold of him, because he is, like we discussed before, he is just an absolute goal machine. He's got the same, perhaps even more kind of single-minded... Well, he's just louder about it, more brash and more kind of obvious. But I think they share the same trait, which is just a single-minded focus on scoring goals every time they're on the pitch. And so, yeah, he's the number one, I would suggest. But, you know, as Paul Hurst reported this week, I think I wouldn't be surprised to see City testing Tottenham with Harry Kane if that didn't come to fruition. And... Mbappe, I'm slightly less sure about. I think, you know, I'm sure they would be desperate to have him, but I'm not sure personally that he would come. So, but Haaland's the number one. I just think, you know, it's easy to say, actually, that yes, he won't be able to move for statues. It's easy to say someone might surpass him, but I mean, the distance between him and the next leading Manchester City goal scorer is enormous, and I wouldn't say that too easily. I think what he's done has been remarkable, and you know, players staying at a club for a decade is not very commonplace anymore. So I think he'll take some beating.
That being said, if you invest in someone like Erling Haaland, they could easily stay for a decade, especially if they're scoring goals at the rate he currently is. But I like the idea that Harry Kane might be the player that comes in, and Manchester City might test the resolve of Daniel Levy. Jonathan, could you envisage it?
Hugh, you like the idea? What as a Manchester United fan, why would you like Harry Kane at Man City? I think that'd be terrifying for the Premier League, wouldn't it?
Listen, I've got a lot of stick in the past saying that I'd have Lionel Messi at Manchester City if it meant he was in the Premier League and not in Liga or playing football in the MLS or somewhere else. You know, look, yeah. You know, you've got to understand Manchester City have that sort of financial clout these days. And I'd rather see the greatest players in the world playing in the Premier League than not. So, yeah, there's a little bit of putting country before club for me. You know, call me one of those types of people.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And, of course, if Harry Kane's going to go anywhere, we do want to see him stay in the Premier League. And, by the way, I think Manchester United would have to get themselves in that conversation, because if ever there was a player they're crying out for, I think it's Harry Kane. But Haaland, we know, is City's kind of preferred option, like it is most clubs, it would seem, you know, Chelsea included. I was reading details this week of what Mina Raiola might be asking for, and that gave me pause for thought, because it would be outside of City's way of operating to give so much to a player. You know, they do pay high wages, they pay big transfer fees, but they have got a structure. And it would seem that wherever Haaland goes, it's going to have to be, you know, for this country, an unprecedented wage package. And remember, City backed out of Alexis Sanchez for exactly that reason. So that makes me wonder whether he will go to City after all, if those wage demands are really what he's going to ask for. And of course, Harry Kane, you'd get the finished article now. And in Haaland, you'd get the guy for the next 10 years. So in some ways, if Guardiola's going to stay for another 4 years, he couldn't really lose out of it. It would be more the long-term thing.
Share the deets, Jonathan. What are we talking in terms of wages?
Well, I'm trying to remember if it was a Hursty piece or from a rival newspaper, but it was looking at something like £600,000 a week for Haaland. You know, a package unprecedented in Premier League history. Obviously, that could be made up by huge signing on bonuses and not necessarily, you know, basic pay. But that would be the salary package, and that's similar to what Alexis Sanchez's deal with how that was structured. And from what how Raiola operates, it would be entirely in keeping with his way, which is simply to get the best deal for the player. And you know, when Haaland went to Dortmund, he engineered a sort of beauty parade of interested clubs, and it does seem that he's likely to try and get four or five big clubs interested and then try and play them off against each other again.
It's going to be a big summer for that guy, Erling Braut Haaland. I think he's going to enjoy it wherever he does end up. Yeah, could be a huge salary, but I think Manchester City are the sort of club, they will go out and get a frontline talent. Who knows? They might discover another gem. But I think the likelihood is they've got options this summer, especially getting Sergio Aguero's wages off their bill. But you've got to give credit to him. Unbelievable, Sergio Aguero. 257 goals for the club, and really a long-lasting legacy he will leave in the Premier League when he probably departs this summer, unless someone thinks another Premier League club will go in for Sergio Aguero, could go in for Sergio Aguero. Tom, what do you think?
I think it's maybe the other way around. I think Aguero might fancy sticking around for another year. I mean, there were reports earlier this week or last week that Chelsea would consider doing it, which I'm not so sure would happen. But I think it just suggests that he wants to stick around, and he could be, you know, on a year contract, he would be a fantastic solution for a lot of clubs, even though the wages are high. But earlier saying about Mino Raiola's name was what came to my mind earlier when you mentioned about Erling Haaland maybe staying for 10 years, because that's not what Raiola clients tend to do.
True.
Listen, I just like the idea that maybe he'll go to Manchester United after the whole welcome to Manchester stuff with Carlos Tevez. Like, get one back, sign Sergio Aguero, make a big song and dance about it, and, you know, shut up the noisy neighbours, in the words of Sir Alex Ferguson. Up next, we turn our attention to the international break. We'll come to England, the seniors and the under-21s during part two. But first up, it's Scotland, who are unbeaten after their three games in Group F. After a 2-2 home draw with Austria, it finished 1-1 against Israel in Tel Aviv and a 4-0 win this week over the Faroe Islands. Gregor, they're second in the early running in the group behind Denmark. They will feel confident in this group, though, Scotland, won't they? They can go and qualify, if not with the top spot, then certainly a playoff spot, second place. We all know the drama of that, don't we? What did you make of Scotland's start to qualify?
I think this was a kind of well-needed boost because, the two earlier draws were pretty flat, I thought, actually. Scotland, as Michael Grant put in his report today, Scotland have dropped points against the Faroes in the past. There's no, this is no foregone conclusion. And we've also struggled for goals. So to score four goals. And I think we're seeing the value of John McGinn slightly pushed slightly forward. He's timing into the box. He's becoming a bit of a talisman, actually, for Scotland. And also, I thought Kieran Tierney was outstanding. We always sort of laugh about the fact that Scotland have probably got two world-class players in their team and they're both left-backs. Getting both of those players playing to their maximum in the Scotland team will be a huge asset for Scotland, I think. So, yeah, I also think McTominay back in the back three, the fact he moved into central midfield, he was excellent in the kind of qualifying period last year when he played in the back three. I thought he was, I was a bit worried about that, but he's been outstanding there. I actually prefer him there. And I think midfield is one of Scotland's strongest areas. So you've got McLean and McGregor who are capable of doing the defensive side, but they're also, good passers of the ball, have a kind of creative streak as well. I think there's kind of a bit better balance there. And then the other thing is Jay Adams getting his first goal, which was a lovely strike from outside the box. Nice little turn. I think he's someone who can produce a moment, just a moment from nothing, that we didn't really have before. So I think he'll be a good addition. So, this was obviously it was against the Faroe Islands, but it was a welcome result. And yeah, when you look at the group, Denmark are going to win it, I think, and it's going to be about beating Austria for second spot. So, I still think Scotland are in with a good shout. And first of all, though, we've got to concentrate on the Euros.
Absolutely.
Which is nice to say.
Absolutely.
Nice to be able to say.
Well, you can use the Euros in many ways, Johnny, to help your World Cup qualifying campaign when you come back next season as well, because there will be, I think, this summer for Scotland fans and players alike, a huge boost of playing those games, of being at a major tournament, of feeling the atmosphere and the experience and wanting to do that again the year after. And it'll be the same group of players pretty much who get that opportunity. They did come from behind in those first two games, Scotland, which I think was important as well, because you can turn a negative, into a positive. How did you see it? Just that ability to do that.
Yeah, I thought that was very important and a sign of progress. As Gregor said, Scotland were a bit tired, let's say, in both of those games, particularly the one in Israel. Maybe it's just familiarity, just played them too often. But the fact that Scotland got themselves out of a hole in both games and probably should have won both games in the end is progress. And yeah, I think we've learned that Denmark are going to win the group. But if it is Scotland v Austria, then they had Austria had a very damaging defeat to the Danes last night, which will help Scotland. I think the job for Scotland will be to avoid defeat in Vienna and try and pick a point off Denmark maybe and make the difference between us and Austria that way. And like Gregor, I'm sort of looking at it in terms of development. I think anytime Scotland find a striker, it's a eureka moment. I mean, so Che Adams to supplement the great Lyndon Dykes is fantastic. And I think he really can offer something for Scotland. I think we rehabilitated Ryan Fraser a little bit, who's important for us because we need pace and he provides it. And that was good to see. I think as well, we probably learned that Scotland do need to stick with that back three, because as well as it maybe giving McTominay a role that he really suits, I think it helps that left-sided tandem. The interplay between Tierney and Robertson was fabulous last night. And when they played in the 4-3-3, you know, that kind of means playing Robertson a bit too high up the pitch, I think. He prefers to come from a little bit deeper. So there were signs... There were signs everywhere that were encouraging, and I think the important thing is to have maintained that momentum going. You know, if these three qualifiers had been disappointing, that would have made us go into the Euros with the sort of wind out of ourselves, and just keeps the buoyancy up. And yeah, we have dropped points to the Faroes. I was there at one of the games in Tofte when we did. So we can't be too. Yes, it's just the Faroes, but we can't turn our noses up at any 4-0 victory, Scotland.
Yeah, I mean, we're still at heart.
Tempered optimism.
Absolutely, we're still, still at heart. We
exactly
are still
what I was expecting.
We are still defeatist at heart, absolutely. So, you know, we can't shake that just after one qualification.
No. Exactly.
I don't know whether it's the tempered optimism that makes me tempted to say, you know, this is, I've got the feeling this could be the Wales of 2018
yes.
at the Euros. This is
yeah.
like
yeah,
probably
that,
you've got Kieran Tierney doing the Gareth Bale job with three assists. It's on.
The thing about it is it does have that feel, not just because of the emotion that goes into it, but because of the tactics that are going into it. You'll remember Northern Ireland getting to the Euros, playing a very similar style. In terms of the formation, the same with Wales as well, which is basically saying, you know, we're not going to outplay teams. We need to be slightly defensive. We've put three at the back. I think for Scotland, it works, particularly as you've said, they fit Kieran Tierney and Andrew Robertson in. But Tom, it's very important at international football. We spent the last two podcasts arguing over England's formation. How should they play? What works? No need for that when it comes to Scotland in many ways, because I think they are most solid with this formation. And also, I believe in international football that having that consistency of just knowing how you're going to play actually helps a squad that's not together that often.
There also feels like an element of the timing, or the pieces of the puzzle all sort of falling into place and the timing being right, because you've got, as you said, you know, fitting two of the best left backs in Europe at the moment, fitting them into the same team so well. But also, you know, the guys mentioned John McGinn, who I think is still an underrated player. And if it weren't for his, I think it was an ACL injury a couple of years ago, you know, where he would have gone from there. And he's just getting back to that form now. As Johnny said about Ryan Fraser's sort of rehabilitation with Scotland, and Che Adams, I mean, to get him at the moment, he had his move to Southampton, and he famously, you know, took, I think, 30 or 31 games to get a goal for Southampton. But he always looked dangerous, and he's coming of age as well. So it just all feels like it's falling into place slightly. And Chris, Steve Clarke has got that. He's got a bit of a Chris Coleman about him.
Really? In what way? I wonder how Steve Clarke would react to that.
Michael O'Neill. Okay.
Yeah, I was about to say, Michael O'Neill. Care not to elaborate on that one. Just quickly, finally, on Scotland, an early call at this point, Gregor. I know you've alluded to it already. Will Scotland make it?
Look, I think, I honestly don't want to look beyond the Euros now. I just think we're so overjoyed to be there. And there's going to be so much goodwill towards this team in the summer. And we will have to see how that goes, because, you know, again, well, let's just stick to the defeatist mindset here. You know, we've got a tough task on our hands. So I think once that's out of the way, and also we'll need to see about, you know, will Steve Clarke remain? I hope he will. But you never know. He's kind of, I think he's done his reputation no harm. So, you know, there's a lot of question marks, and that's all a long way away. It's also very peculiar that you begin the kind of qualifications for the next tournament before the Euros start, and it's you know, there's a lot of changes. There's a lot of players as well that you could foresee Billy Gilmore perhaps sort of emerging. I just want to see him getting some first team football because, boy, he's the kind of player we don't have. You know, we've got McGregor and McLean and Armstrong, you know, players who are really solid players who I think, you know, can play in the Premier League. But Billy Gilmore is kind of something very different to any of them. So I'd love to see him getting embedded into the team. So I'm not willing to say, sorry.
Jonathan, I imagine you're the same.
Yeah, I mean, and we're in the Euros, we're in a tournament. You know, that's all we can think of. It really is. And what is beyond that is a bit of a bonus. So I think we should just need to do well in the summer. And Scotland have got a good draw in the Euros, as in the way the fixtures work out in the group. I think really, you know, it's better for Scotland than it is for England, just the pathway. So I think there's a chance to get out of that group. And if Scotland do that, you know, that's something that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. So I'm just thinking about that at the moment.
Just finally, you obviously went to the Faroe Islands and saw Scotland lose. What was the best thing about the trip for those of us that haven't been? Oh, a draw, sorry.
Yeah, it was a draw. It was an amazing trip because they've got a different pitch now. They've got an all-weather pitch in the capital, Tórshavn. But in those days, they played in Toftir, which the Faroes is a collection of islands, as the name suggests. And Toftir is one of the more remote ones of the main islands. So you basically, the airport is on like a sort of hill, a cliff rather, that's got a kind of flat bit at the top. You land on the cliff, you go to the main island with Tórshavn, where, by the way, night out in Tórshavn has to be seen to be believed in terms of the revelry that goes on in a North European island where there's nothing else to do but drink. And then you go to another island, which is Toftir, which is where the game was. The Toftir Stadium was basically a little hotel with a football pitch outside of it. The press box was a hotel room. We're all given rooms in this hotel to watch the game. And then the other side of the stadium was kind of open, so you could see people literally coming across the fields, you know, that had sheep in them and stuff, that locals were coming across to see this international. It was Matt Elliott's international debut and competitive debut, and there was a female lines woman for the first time in international football, and she ended up, he got sent off, she ended up flagging because he elbowed someone off the ball. And we skated with a 1-1 or 2-2 draw and had to then race all the way back on two different ferries to get to the cliff that had the airport on it to get our chartered flight home. It was an amazing trip. And my computer battery gave out just as I filed while I was on the tarmac to take off. So I'm still sort of recovering from it, really, 19 years later.
Well, that's our conversation about Scotland wrapped up anyway. Up next, we're going to touch on Gareth Southgate's England and what next for the England under-21s after their Euros disaster. But remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, you can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. Also, make sure you're subscribed. You won't miss the next episode or any of our award-winning journalism. Get yourself a digital subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times across all of your devices. Sign up today for 1 month free. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times with myself, Hugh Wisencroft. Today, Gregor Robertson, Jonathan Northcroft and Tom Roddy. Let's quickly mention England's seniors and their World Cup qualifiers before we go on to the under-21s and their current malaise. Tom and Johnny, we like to have receipts on this podcast, you know, get everyone's view. You haven't yet had your say on England over the past couple of weeks. Three wins from three in terms of the start of their qualifying. Have you been impressed, Tom, by what you've seen, or maybe have your expectations for the summer come a little bit further down to earth?
In a bizarre way, it's maybe a little bit of both at times, in that it was exciting to see the guys who you kind of thought might have a chance, and really sort of pushing forward the opportunity. I mean, I thought Calvin Phillips was absolutely excellent, and throughout the games, and Mason Mount, really, for me, he's a starter now. He really cemented his place in the team. Where he fits in is a question that needs to be answered. And then that's probably the thing that troubles me a little bit. I mean, we're in April now, before the summer, and I'm still not entirely sure what the starting 11 is, and I think it's my turn to be a little defeatist now. That's what makes me feel a little bit unsure. It feels like we need an element of a bit of a rhythm going into the tournament, which, despite the wins, I'm not entirely sure we've got. And also, of course, there's the question mark about the defence. I mean, you know, one mistake from John Stones doesn't unravel what he's done over this season, but then it does put the question mark in your mind as to whether it is working alongside Ruben Diaz at Manchester City, and whether him and Harry Maguire will be quite as successful. So a little bit of both, really. I think I am exactly where I was about a month ago.
God, we're miserable today, aren't we?
I know, that was tempered optimism, wasn't it, Tom? That's very Scottish of you.
It's contagious, clearly.
Jonathan, what do you think about England over the past three games?
Yeah, a bit like Tom, it's a mix. I mean, I was actually In watching the first half against Poland last night, because, you know, the first two games are sort of, they're not gimmies, but they're typical England qualifiers against lesser nations where you don't really learn a lot. So I really was looking at the Poland game as the one that is going to be the biggest indicator for the Euros. And in the first half, I was thinking, it is coming together, this. England's pressing was fantastic, and you could see with Mount and Foden together how much that gives an ability to win the ball high up the pitch. And, you know, Mount is clearly going to be one of the, if not the key player for England in the Euros, apart from Harry Kane. And he was terrific in that first half. But it was the way England then didn't capitalise on their supremacy with Poland there for the taking in that first half. And then when they had the setback of losing the goal, I kind of don't mind John Stones' mistake, because I'd be willing to write that off as just one of those things and you know, trust that he's not going back to bad old habits, and you know, England will get the Man City John Stones at the Euros. But what concerned me, I suppose, was the, once it went to 1-1, was just England's one-dimensionality, if that's a word. There was just no way of stretching the opposition and breaking them down. There was nothing happening wide. But I think both fullbacks were either not licensed to push high or just weren't capable of stretching the opposition. Because there was no Rashford, there was no real pace in behind. So it meant Poland could play quite comfortably, knowing that they weren't going to be stretched either horizontally or vertically, and England were playing in front of them. And, you know, really, it took the set piece, didn't it, to get England out of trouble, which made me just think, has that much changed? And clearly, Jack Grealish or Phil Foden or Marcus Rashford is going to be perhaps the key decision for Southgate in the Euros. The other aspect is, of course, Jordan Henderson could come back and take over from Phillips, and that might... Phillips did play well, but maybe Henderson would offer a bit more game management or savvy to help England in that kind of situation when they really needed to change their ideas. And of course, that should be said as well, Southgate was odd with his substitutions. He didn't do much to change either. So, as I say, it was a bit of a Sven thing. First half good, second half not so good. And I went away with questions in the end.
Southgate substitutions have been a theme, though, haven't they? Especially, you know, in the bigger games. He comes across as a slightly timid manager at times. So I think we've all got used to that, and we'll have to be used to it for the summer as well. Who do you think the big winners and losers in terms of the players were during this window, looking ahead to the European Championship squad, Gregor?
I have to say that, you know, Kyle Walker's come back in and kind of made you realise how good a player he is. And, like, you know, he's been taken a bit of stick by certain pundits and stuff, but he's still... I mean, he's so fast. And he can also...
That's amazing.
He can also... I know we're talking about the different formations and stuff, but he can also slot into the right side of a three, which is something, you know, within a game you might choose to do. I think maybe even did it when they scored the second goal, I think, just to kind of see it at the end of the game. So, yeah, Kyle Walker. And from that point of view, Trent Alexander-Arnold is a loser. I don't see him getting the squad. He's going to have to do something pretty remarkable between now and the end of the season to do so. I have to agree with Tom. I think Phillips, you know, if Henderson's not fit, I think Phillips wouldn't be someone you... I think Phillips is someone you could rely on. I agree, though, that, you know, as Johnny says, he just... I spoke about this last week, just something about having a bit of presence and a bit of experience at this level, experience in European football. And when you see that John Stones still kind of possibly got a reckoning like that behind him, Maguire's still not always convinced, Rice is, what, 22 or something, maybe younger. You know, just having that slightly older head with a bit of nous would kind of just the impression you get looking at that block of four, which has got to be England's base, would change a little bit. So, but you know, I personally think there's a lot to be happy about from this international break for England. In that, I would say this, but they've gone back to a back four and they've found room to get another attacking player on the pitch. Mount has excelled, and I just think there's always going to be this sort of embarrassment of riches in the wide areas, and choosing who's going to play is going to come down to form and the opposition. So I think England know a lot more about what their base is, and it's about deciding upon the attacking players who's going to go and try and win them the game, I think.
It did make me wonder as well whether, maybe this is the optimistic side coming out, whether in a similar way to Scotland, that the pieces of the puzzle are falling into place a little bit, because there's a nice blend in the squad and the runners and the riders who are actually involved, because you've got Walker who is at, you know, his prime and playing extremely well, but with the experience. You've got Harry Kane, who is at the best he's ever been in terms of goal contributions going into this tournament. And if his ankles stay in a safe place and are protected, then that's very important. But then there's also our best talent coming through are also they're not kids anymore. I mean, Mason Mount 2 years ago hadn't played a game for Chelsea, and now he's their most important player and nearly, he's worn the captain's armband a couple of times. And the thing is, he's not new to Gareth Southgate. Gareth Southgate managed him in the senior, in the youth squads. You've got Phil Foden, who's had really he's been promising, so promising for such a long time, and this has really been his his kind of breakout season in a way, where he's had the kind of rhythm to play more frequently and has more often than, you know, more often than before been City's main guy. So there feels like a nice blend that England have going into this tournament.
Johnny, would you say anyone is massively harmed or massively boosted their chances for the summer?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mount and Rice, who are two players that Southgate has loved for a long time and has had faith in maybe before they were as compelling as they are now, they hugely advanced their core. They both had great international cycles. They both have emerged, I think, as the two sort of key players in the spine of the pitch, and you know, you'd have to say Southgate's faith in them has been justified. They look really top international class players now. In terms of losers, I mean, I actually wonder if Nick Pope might have ended up as a loser, having not conceded a goal until his, what, 7th or his 8th international, done pretty much everything right, and the one thing he did, and it wasn't even 100% wrong, but that pass to John Stones, which then, you know, Stones probably, it's the bulk of it, it's his mistake, but it wasn't a great pass. And it was just that moment where I think Southgate will look at it and think, does he have the ability with his feet that Jordan Pickford's got? Is he comfortable enough on the ball? I'm not sure about that. Because we know Gareth will probably look for reasons to put Pickford back in. So I wonder if right at the death, Pope managed to become a loser out of that. And the other person I think of is Eric Dier, who didn't get near the pitch, did he? And everybody else seemed to play. So he must now be looking at best being a bag carrier in the squad if he makes it.
Let's look at the England under-21s next, though. They went crashing out of the European Championship at the group stage for the fifth time in the last six in this competition. Adey Boothroyd's side finished bottom of their group, two defeats and a win. They only had one shot on goal from open play in their first two games. Question marks. In fact, that's totally wrong, isn't it? They only had one shot on goal, and that was from a free kick. They only had one shot on goal in their first two games, and that came from a free kick. There were question marks over how Boothroyd approached the tournament full stop. He left Crystal Palace's Eberechi Eze, Conor Gallagher of West Brom, Liverpool's Curtis Jones, Sheffield United's Rhian Brewster really on the periphery of his team until that final win. Adey Boothroyd's called it the utterly impossible job. He's also implied it's impossible to succeed in it given the remit to produce players for England's senior team. We're going to get into that in a moment. But Tom, I think in terms of these three matches, there was every right for football fans back at home to be unhappy with how the under-21s performed.
Yeah. But I think the two feed into each other because, you know, this is... I do think that the way in which they performed was largely to do with the way in which they were set out to perform. And of course, it isn't, as you alluded to, Hugh, this isn't the first time either. In 2019, Adey Boothroyd had a really talented team, a talented squad, in fact, and it wasn't really used to its potential, and there were some very odd decisions made, and they were out within two games. And the thing is, it's history has repeated itself here, and of course, what I've written a piece today actually for the website, which looks at a question that Boothroyd sort of posed himself, which is this job to produce players for the first team for Gareth Southgate, or is this job to win tournaments like this? And of course, I would say it's a little bit of both. And I think that was why he referred it to it as the utterly impossible job, because of having to do the two at the same time. And there is an element of difficulty there because you get players like, say, Jude Bellingham, who's 17 years old, and they called him up last year, and he played and was one of the better players, as he has been at all the teams he's played in. And then suddenly he's called up to the seniors. So you can't really, you have that upheaval and it's hard to have a certainty over the players who are going to be available to you. But at the moment, the depth that England have at this level is so exciting, really. And I think that's why these performances were just so utterly disappointing, because you've got players like Eberechi Eze and Curtis Jones and Conor Gallagher, who aren't starting the games to begin with, who are regulars in the Premier League, and we know their quality, and especially a player like Eze, who just is such a joy to watch gliding across the turf. And it seemed like they were shackled. I mean, they didn't manage a shot on target from open play in the opening two games, and it was only really when they were on the brink that they started playing, and they had five players out injured. And then, of course, the goalposts move a little bit from we want to win the tournament to we're producing players for the first team, and we've seen it this week with Mason Mount, Phil Foden and Dominic Calvert-Lewin. So, yeah, it's a tricky situation, I think. I do wonder whether there'll be a new man in the job this year.
Yeah, maybe. We'll come to Eddie Boothroyd's future in a moment. But, Jonathan, look, Spain don't have a problem with it. The Netherlands don't, Germany don't. In fact, they've used the vehicle of the under-21s to produce sides that have done extremely well in major tournaments. So do England miss the point of it all, but in the fact that maybe they accelerate people through the process too quickly?
They do a little bit. And we've got a manager that's particularly keen, as in Gareth Southgate, he's particularly keen on drawing players through the system quickly. He believes in that. But I have to say, you're right to make those comparisons. Other nations do better with it. And when I saw, I just think England have had the wrong under-21 managers, quite frankly. And when I saw the idea that it's the most impossible job, I mean, I sort of spat my tea out. I mean, an impossible job is trying to keep West Brom in the Premier League, or managing Derby County, or being in charge of Ipswich or Sunderland or something like that. Do you know what I mean? It's not managing an under-21 team where there's very little pressure and scrutiny. You've got lots of brilliant players. You really should do qualify for tournaments all the time. And even when you go to the tournament, there's enough good players to at least get a shot and goal in your first two games, or get a point before your last game. And get out of the group. I mean, no one's saying Eddie Boothroyd had to win this tournament. He should have just got out of the group. And this wasn't his first attempt at it. So I'm afraid, impossible job, no. It's probably quite a cushy number, actually. Let's be honest.
Gregor, you played for Scotland at this level, the under-21s. Was it all about development and preparing you for the senior team, or was there more of an emphasis on results?
I think, first of all, we're kind of all alluding to, seems to be a slightly strange attitude towards the under-21s, which isn't maybe not shared in other countries. And yeah, as you say, this eagerness to fast track players into the team. And then when they have to drop back, then that changes their kind of their appreciation of playing for the under-21s. I remember the first time I was called up for Scotland's 21s. Archie Gemmell had scouted me. It was an end of season trip to Ireland, I think. And I had to cancel my holiday and stuff like that, and I turned up and we had four subs. So like the attitude wasn't, there was players who were playing for the Old Firm in Scotland who were playing in Champions League football and possibly thought that they should be in the Scotland senior team, and some of them later were, but they weren't overly eager to join up at the end of a season to play for the 21s. That's the truth of it. That's the reality of it.
Was that clear, Gregor?
Oh, abundantly clear. I found it quite surprising when I just joined up, and as I say, cancelled a trip to New York. so that's, and it is strange. It is strange. I think it's kind of, I don't know, it's something about once you've made that step into an established senior professional, you are returning to play in underage football, and there's something about that which is slightly jarring, although you're playing for your country, and it should be a step into the, you know, into the senior ranks potentially. So I think I know I dropped a big clanger last week, but when we played Spain, Cesc Fabregas was given his debut for the 21s, and he'd already played for Arsenal for a year in the first team. So, like, that was he was a sub. He came on in the second half. And, like, so some of it, you know, some of that is to do with who was in front of him. And some of it is to do with the attitudes, I think, the eagerness in this country. We think, oh my God, we've got a young star here. Let's get him in the team. Let's get him acquainted with everyone else and sort of familiar with the setup. And, you know, there could be some positives for that as well. It's a difficult balance, I think. But coming back to it, it's, as Johnny said, it would help if you have a manager who can even give the slightest impression of getting the best out of the players when they do turn up for the 21s. And there is no impression of that. Because, as we said, this is the latest group in a long list. Grealish, Chilwell, Ward-Prowse, Pickford, and all them. Then the last tournament, it was Madison, Foden wasn't playing. You're thinking, what is going on here? Now you're seeing Eze and real serious talents. It's just all, he was an odd fit from the start. When I joined Northampton, Chris Wilder had just replaced Eddie Boothroyd. And so there's still all the same players there. And his stock phrase was stick it in the cage. He was so direct. The cage was like the area around the penalty box. So it was an odd fit, that's all I'll say. I'm not saying he's not a good coach, and he's a very positive figure, apparently. But he's an odd fit when you're talking about the development of the creme de la creme of English under-21s players.
Tom, should Boothroyd go now? He's been in charge of the under-21 since 2016.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the thing is, he should probably have gone in 2019. I think he was fortunate to get the renewal of the contract that he got then. And I mean, I think it's on the FA as well, because, you know, in the same way that the you're looking at Boothroyd and the players that he played, I mean, Foden was rested. He was rested in 2019 for the big game. And by the time he was back in for the third one, they were out. In the same way that a manager picks the players, the organisation, the association picks the manager, and they made the mistake a second time in a row, and you assume they wouldn't do it again with his contract expiring this summer. And it just, I mean, one of the issues as well, I think, with Boothroyd, I get the impression, is that it's not just his football tactics. Even though they are kind of limited from what you hear and negative, but also the fact that he just, what we've kind of got to remember is that these are 18, 19, 20 year old lads who don't really know, didn't really know a lot about Eddie Boothroyd before they got told he was manager of the under 21s or under 20s at the time before then. So it doesn't carry the cachet of a bigger name.
It's not about development. Let's be honest about it, because these guys are all playing first team football, men's first team football. And if they were kind of tearing up trees, they'd be in the senior team, as some of the players are, like Phil Foden. So when you're called up for the 21s, that's where you are right at that point in time. Our manager was Rainer Bonhoff, guy who'd, you know, won the World Cup. He was a kind of, that was in the Bertie Vogts era. But we didn't win enough games, and ultimately his job came under pressure, and he lost his job eventually. So it is about when you turn up there. It's not actually on them to develop those players. It's not really. Your development happens away from the international scene. You turn up, play for your country, and your job is to win. It is. I know there's a pathway, and this is the kind of last rung of the pathway. But these guys are all already first team regulars. Their development happens away from the international scene. When they turn up, they should be going to win or to do the best they can in the tournament.
There's a backdrop here where club fans are already negative about senior football. And the idea, let's say, of a Trent going to the under-21s, which I totally agree with from a development point of view, if he's not going to be in the senior squad, which he should be, brackets, but if he's not, put him in the 21s. From a development point of view, but imagine trying to sell that to Liverpool fans. I mean, you know, that's another issue we've got. Already club fans don't want to see their players join up with the senior squad. They're not going to want to see them join up with the under-21s. We need to recalibrate our thinking towards the whole thing.
Our final point on today's podcast is about North Macedonia. We've discussed the seniors for England, Scotland, the under-21s, of course, but North Macedonia pretty much had the shock of the World Cup qualifiers in the past 10 days. They beat Germany 2-1 last night. It included, by the way, another horrendous miss from Chelsea's Timo Werner. But it ended a 35-match unbeaten run for the Germans in World Cup qualifying that went all the way back to... Does anyone know the result?
Yeah,
you do?
Yeah.
Go on, Johnny. Yeah, yeah. Go on. I would love a Scotsman telling me about this one. Go on, mate.
So there was a team that won 5-1 against the team that then went to the World Cup final.
Since the 5-1 drubbing by England, you're right, Jonathan Northcroft, back in 2001. So it got us thinking on the greatest international shocks of all time. But maybe you guys have been to a game where there was a huge shock in international football, or one that stands out from your memory as a fan.
I was at the World Cup 98 when Croatia beat Germany, which wasn't a shock when you look at the players, but it reverberated around the world because Germany were, you know, Croatia were a new name. It was their first World Cup, and Germany were Germany, and it was just incredible that they hammered them. But I also think of Senegal beating France, which was incredible in 2002. And, you know, the one for my generation is probably the opening game of Italia 90, which was just unforgettable, absolutely unforgettable. When Argentina came a cropper against Cameroon in a remarkable game. Go and YouTube that and look at some of the tackling. But yeah, so those are the ones I think about. And I think in 1950 there was a shock in that World Cup as well. Some team lost to the USA who had like a peanut seller up front or something.
There was one in 2016, wasn't there, as well? Was it some Icelandic?
Yeah, I was at that game, yeah. I forgot about that one. So there's been a few, yeah.
We won't win this, Johnny. We won't win this. I think we should leave it there.
England lost to Iceland. Yeah, we've lost a few. We've had a few coming on social media as well. Senegal beating France in the 2002 World Cup. Someone says, can Greece beating Portugal in 2004 count if they beat them twice in the same tournament and also beat France along the way? Very good point. Yeah, but it was still a shock for most of us watching at home. Tom, any come to mind for you?
I mean, I was similar to Johnny in that I thought of the Senegal-France in 2002. And that tournament really was the tournament of the international shock in a way, because you had that Senegal-France game, and of course they were reigning champions at the time, weren't they, France? But it was a pretty disastrous campaign. So in hindsight, it wasn't the biggest surprise. Whereas South Korea going into that tournament, we expected them to be quite good, being the host nation, but to beat Italy in the last 16, and then to reach the semi-finals was such a sensational story. And I think, I mean, giving away my age a little bit, but I was reasonably young at the time. So I think you were too, Gregor.
But not me.
Do you know what though? Listen, that's one of those magical football stories that would never have happened if there was VAR. So let's just, you know, let's just remember that for all of you at pro VAR people. That's all we've got time for. Thank you for being with me for the last hour or so. Tom Roddy, Jonathan Northcroft, and Gregor Robertson, I'll see you very, very soon. And thank you to all of you for listening as well. Reminder, you can get yourself a digital subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times as well for more of our award-winning journalism across all of your devices. Sign up today for 1 month free. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started. The Premier League is back this weekend and we will be back on Monday.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.